Hi, I am Matt Vaughn from Easy Street Records, and this is The State of Love and Trust.
Welcome again to another episode of The State of Love and Trust. It's a Pearl Jam podcast, and I'm one of your two hosts, Jason Carapesi, and alongside me, as always, is...
Paul Guillieri.
Paul, I'm very excited for this week, this week's episode. Thrilled. I should say. Yep. It's going to be big, it's going to be huge, and we have a great guest on tap today. Mm-hmm. He is the founder and owner of Easy Street Records. It's Record Store Week. Can I call it a week?
We can. Yeah, let's pound the pavement. Matt, we'll pop Vaughn into the store with Matt Vaughn.
That's right. Before we get to Matt, and we're gonna get there very shortly because he's got a lot to say, and I can't wait for you guys to hear this. I want to remind you that if you want to help out the show, go ahead and
rate
this video.
Well, you can do that too.
Which way are we gonna go? We gonna go YouTube first? We gonna go audio only first?
Let's play with the visual.
Okay, so. Like I said, you can go ahead and like and subscribe and hit the bell. That would be super helpful. And for our friends who still listen to the audio only, Paul, what are they doing?
You can listen to the guy who rudely interrupted Jason just moments ago. And you can tear open the cellophane by rating, reviewing, and subscribing in your preferred podcast platform of choice. Feed that algorithm. And algorithm, by the way, we're going to talk a little bit about algorithms in this upcoming interview, aren't we?
We sure are. I'm going to ante things up here for you. If you're considering writing a review, why not get one of these bad boys?
Oh, boy.
Oh, my goodness. Look at this. You know what that is?
I like the mojo in your hand there.
Yeah. People who are listening only have no clue what you mean by that. That could go any which way. Mojo Magazine featuring these gentlemen on the cover, Pearl Jam, with their exclusive interview. I'm going to give this bad boy away. It concludes the CD, by the way, the live rarity CD. If you want to go ahead and write a review, we're going to pick one over the next couple of weeks. And you'll get that for free, just for writing a review. Because you know what? Writing reviews helps people find this show more. Apple Podcasts love this thing. So go ahead and write a review. Get a free magazine. There you go. Real quick, if you want to help the show even more, there is Patreon. Link is right here. Yeah. Extra episodes, bonus content, giveaways each month. This month's giveaway is the full LP of Dark Matter. I know it comes out in a couple of days, but you can get a copy for free if you're a patron. We'll pick that at the end of the month. There is that. And that's all the shilling we're going to do today. Let's get to it, Paul.
Can't wait.
All right. Here he is, Matt Vaughn. And joining us now, the founder and president, CEO, dictator, I don't know what you want to call him.
It's Matt. Estate manager.
There you go. Matt Vaughn from Easy Street Records. How's it going?
Hey, good, good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us on the show, man.
Thank you.
Before we get into it, you know, I'm rocking my shirt here, as you just pointed out before we got going. And it has a van.
Yeah.
Now, right, I don't want to... I don't need to go into the whole story, but is this based off the Brandi Carlile van or not?
I have the Brandi Carlile van now. That particular van I had for 20 some years, and that would go between, that was the van I used buying record collections.
So you've told the story of your mother starting the record industry, right? Yeah. And essentially forming Queensryche, which you'll touch on when you talk about that flying V behind you in a minute, but forming this band out of thin air at a battle of the bands, as it were, right? And then getting them signed to EMI. So with the advent of things like YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, you know, you get all these artists getting noticed pretty quickly by millions and millions of people, almost making an A&R person's job a heck of a lot easier and borderline redundant. You know, how much more impressed are you, I guess, when you think about what your mom did with that band now, considering the current reality?
Great question. Well, first of all, you know, it was a misogynist world more so back then, especially for women in the record business. And, yeah, so she had been an independent radio promoter in the 70s during the era of Casablanca, be that Kiss and Donna Summer, and then also MCA with The Who and Elton John, Motown with Stevie Wonder, and so many other labels. And yeah, that was the era of payola and all that. And she thrived in it. She did very well. Her claim to fame is she was the first person, man or woman, to get Bob Marley played on commercial radio, which happened here on KBR in Seattle. Around that time or shortly thereafter, you had women like Wendy Dio and, of course, Susan Silver step into the arena. But yeah, she was a torchbearer for sure. And she's, you know, still with us. Talked to her today, 81 years old. And she, when Queensryche happened, that was 1981, when I would have been 13 years old and my sister was 11. And I still remember, you know, my mom, you know, walking through this heavy metal parking lot into Lake Hills skating rink for the Battle of the Bands. And what she was trying to do is get out of, you know, selling singles, selling records like she was, to getting them on radio. And she wanted to stake out her own claim. She wanted to manage bands, promote local artists. In 1978, she had worked with a band called Stryker, which got signed by Clive Davis on Arista, but they shortly thereafter, after one record got dropped. So this was her second attempt at it. And she knew a lot of people locally. She was a metalhead. And so we walk into Lake Hills and there's a band called Myth playing, which had this 5-octave singer with amazing stage presence. And then I think it was right after that, there was a band called The Mob that played with this dual guitar attack, i.e. KK Downing, Glenn Tipton, that whole new wave of British heavy metal of those, you know, like Scorpions and Maiden and all of that. And my mom said to Jeff, no offense, but if you could get that band, The Mob, minus their singer, I think I could find a way to make that demo happen and get it produced, and we'll see what happens. And 2 months later, they brought in a 5-song demo. And from there, we took a family vacation. I really thought it was a family vacation. We were just Big Ben, Parliament. Yeah. We were in London. But my mom had this alternative motive, which was she wanted to go to Kerrang! Magazine and any other label and publication in London where the new wave of British heavy metal was happening. She met with someone there at Kerrang! Magazine. A month later, a young journalist, Paul Suter was his name, said, I want to write an article on this band. There's something to them. And she said, what's their name? And they didn't have a name yet. So they went with the first track, Queen of the Reich, and Chris DeGarmo, the guitar player, was like, just call it Queensryche and put the umlauts up there because every other metal band.
Who doesn't love a good umlaut?
Yeah.
You know, Motorhead, Motley Crue.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for the question. It's fun recognizing that.
So, okay, let's talk about how AZ Street started, and your stepdad had something to do with that as well. So really a family affair here, and you've told the story many times before. So briefly, you basically, correct me if I'm wrong on any of these details, by the way, you basically assumed responsibility ownership for two stores going out of business and consolidated their inventories, right?
Exactly.
But here's what I find incredible about this, Matt. And I think it's wild because you have one store owned by your stepdad, the one in Bellevue. Mm-hmm. He can't run it because he's in and out of rehab. You know, the other, both of which you worked at, by the way, the owner finds out his wife is cheating on him and he's just over this midlife crisis type stuff. And he decides to go work at a ski lodge,
which he still works at. I just saw him.
He still works at.
Yeah.
I saw your Instagram post a few weeks back. This is wild. You convinced them both to take control of both stores and you're like 18 years old. So here's the question. What do you think allowed you to have the emotional and mental maturity to navigate two very adult problems and take over two dying businesses?
That's that slacker Gen X mentality. You know, there wasn't a lot of opportunities at that time in the late 80s. I was going to college or just getting ready to go to college at CLU. I was in the humanities program. That wasn't going to get me anywhere. The school, CLU, was very similar to, it was very close in proximity to the high school I went to. I knew everybody. It just felt like high school.
This is Capitol Hill area?
Yeah. And so partly I loved record retailing, you know. My boss, Willie, who had Penny Lane Records, a little bit more to that story is that he was also the manager of Metal Church.
Really?
So, yeah. And Metal Church got signed to Elektra Records. Mm-hmm. So he was doing that. Both, you know, my stepfather, Kim Harris, along with my mother, was managing Queensryche. Mm-hmm. Queensryche were very straight-laced guys. Their parents managed each guy themselves. They ran the fan club. They were from the East Side, very suburban, well-educated guys. They all played on the same baseball team. They weren't big partiers. I don't think they ever really were. I've lost touch with most of them, but for the most part, they were pretty straight, and my stepdad wasn't. So he put all that up his nose, and it got a little sketchy because it was hard to tell just, you know, who was paying for these drugs. And, you know, so in high school, you know, my mom, my sister, they were pretty oblivious to it all, codependent, if you will, and didn't want to notice it. And I was just old enough, you know, I was part of that whole less than zero kind of party crowd. I knew what was going on, and I would see him in the guest room with his Scarface mound going. And so I was well aware of what was happening. And, you know, him and I had a contentious relationship, and my mom and I was a mama's boy, and I was protective of my sister. So, but I loved his store, and that's where hence the name Easy Street comes from. I really didn't have I had to pick between the two names to immediately reopen the store or to, without, I don't even think that a day passed where the store wasn't open, the West Seattle location. The Bell Red store, Easy Street, had been shut down though. And I felt bad about that because it did have, even though it was a short lived store, 79 to 86, it did resonate with a lot of kids in that area, and a lot of kids even from Seattle that would come out there because it was a metalhead store. It was also a safe place for kids, and I couldn't get enough of the record store culture. You know, I mean, hence I think that's why they make movies about record stores. You know, and also I wanted to champion local talent, you know, which I saw, you know, I was of that age, and it wasn't necessarily getting all that much exposure other than, you know, like in the Rocket magazine or, Bomb Shelter videos or whatever locally. So, you know, I mean, Mike McCready was one of those early, customers, like my mother and like Pearl Jam, the band, you know, staking out your own claim, that kind of pioneering spirit of the Northwest, you know, and with where society and politics was at the time, I just wanted to do my own thing. And as much as my real father, who's a retired admiral in the Navy, who went to Annapolis and everything, much to his chagrin and even to my mom's, I wanted to give this a go. I didn't want to see these stores, this culture, be defeated. And so, yeah, I concocted the idea of, you know, while you're in rehab, why don't I work with your landlord and try to get the product out of there, because it's all locked up. And Willie seemed to only trust me at his Penny Lane store. I think it was somebody at the, it was someone at the shop that was having the affair with his wife.
Right.
Yeah. So he didn't, and I was the only one that didn't know anything about it. Everybody else did. So he was a bit of a mentor to me. He, you know, just like a basketball coach can be, a football coach can be, a teacher. He was that for me, and he threw me the keys that particular night. We closed together at 9 o'clock. He threw me the keys and said, "I'm not going to be here tomorrow. You know, the store is someone else's opening the store, but within 2 weeks it's gone. But I think that you might be the guy."
And you were able to, oh. And that's, yeah.
Yeah.
So the store like really kind of falls under your stewardship late 80s at this point, right? So you're, yeah, it, what's interesting is, go ahead.
87. Yeah.
87. Okay.
Between 86 and 87, it was in a little bit of a limbo. Nobody knew who was running it.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, though, is that this is happening right around the same time a lot of these record stores around town are kind of struggling to pivot, right? Because you have cassettes, you have CDs coming in. It's kind of the advent of a brand new format or a new medium of experiencing music. And some of these places are like trying to juggle the various video formats as well. So what made you look at this scenario and say, hey, I think I can succeed at this in ways where these others are maybe failing?
Mm-hmm. I started the CD club, which we still have today. And that was people bringing in their used records to trade in for CDs. I didn't have the buying power to buy CDs like Tower, who had two or three stores in the area, as did Warehouse and Sam Goody and all the other chains. And there was another store in West Seattle as well. So everything cost me more. And if you remember, I mean, Dire Straits was $18.99. Chardet was $18.99 on CD. So it was hard to get into that game, and the margins weren't all that good either. You know, you're talking 30, you know, for me, it was like 30%, 40% for maybe the chains. So people were unloading their used records, and then I would give them credit, and they would buy CDs. Now it's kind of reversed.
Yeah, right. It's funny how it works out that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now they're trading their CDs for records. Yeah.
So you nicked the loyalty card thing from like coffee shops around town, right?
Yeah. Yeah. All the coffee carts around town. Yeah.
Right. I wonder, like, you certainly must have been aware about Columbia House's record club.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it became a CD club in the 90s. And I remember, you know, that's where I got my 13 for one kind of thing, for a penny. Obviously it must be hard to compete with that. Like how did your loyalty thing compare? Did you see issues with that, or were you just like, let's just try it and hopefully people stay loyal to this?
Yeah, no, that worked out just fine. You know, at the same time we were selling a lot of cassettes, and there's a lot of high schools in West Seattle. So, you know, the whole hip hop community and the Mix-a-Lot posse was in West Seattle. So it wasn't, I'd say 50% of our sales were cassettes. They were a little bit cheaper. And in West Seattle, specifically, more so than maybe any other neighborhood in King County, it's a kind of a gearhead, community. I mean, every kid had a car. I was from Capitol Hill. No kids had cars. We were all bikes and skateboards. And in West Seattle, it was old cars that they would fix up. And so, you know, going up and down California Avenue, everyone had a cassette player. So we sold a lot of cassettes. A lot
That's
of
an interesting dynamic. they happened to have cars, so they had cassette decks.
Yeah.
So in regards to like these vinyl fanatics, because to your point, things have really switched around where now vinyl is this preferred medium in a lot of ways. You called them crate diggers, right? And so you said that these folks, that they've kind of like returned to Easy Street and they've gone back to that original time that you nostalgic, you know, wax poetically about nostalgically. And it's because you guys don't really jump on those bandwagons, that you are essentially the wagon. So were there any points over the last 30 plus years when times were basically so tough that you thought, man, I might have to jump on a bandwagon for a minute just to stay afloat? And, you know, in those moments, what did you do, you know, or I guess rather maybe, you know, what did the community at the time do for you?
Yeah. I got on the coffee bandwagon, and we opened a little coffee stand in the shop. I took over the location next door, and that was really just kind of a social club. You know, I had boxing bags and a basketball hoop and things in there, and it wasn't open to the public necessarily. It was really just storage. I was storing a lot of used records. You know, I at some point had 40,000 to 50,000 used records, and you'd have to make an appointment to go into my basement, and it would look like a DJ Shadow album cover. I mean, nothing was in order. It was just how I got the collections, and I, you know, yeah. So, yeah, I felt that to be impervious to competition and to set myself apart, I needed to be more unique than any store in town. And, at the same time, I understand there was other stores that were reacting to our music scene. But I don't know if they necessarily lived in the same scene as I did, at least the store owners, you know, and then later, you know, with Tower, you know, they went to centralized buying, so they weren't able to react like we were. Yeah, opening the cafe and serving food. I mean, a lot of that was for selfish reasons. There wasn't a great place to get breakfast. There wasn't a great place to get coffee. But my first job ever was working at a rec center, you know, Montlake Community Rec Center, you know, scoring basketball games and work in the office and, you know, give me your, you know, school ID and I'll give you a basketball. And, you know, that's what I did. And, so I kind of took that mentality of the rec center, idea, which I loved. And, you know, as Denzel Washington, old wax poetic about, you know, Boys and Girls Club. I mean, that's the rec center was that for me. And, nice. And no surprise that we encourage our young people to come in the shop. We've always been that way. And so we go through this cycle of, you know, you were once a kid and now you've got kids of your own and they're coming through the store and I'm 56 years old now and I even have kids that, you know, that were my age that are now, you know, close to being grandparents or our grandparents, but we're all still working through the Easy Street cycle.
Well, I mean, you are, you know, an Easy Street person. You are not a record business person, as you said. Meaning,
I'm in the Easy Street business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so local customers first and foremost, and that's kind of created a destination effect, not only for the community, but much greater than that, you know, the country, possibly even the world. And I think when you have your favorite band, in our case, Pearl Jam, of course, pumping the store up and gushing about it, like the lore of the place kind of goes up. We want to be there. You know, I bought this shirt a year ago when I was there for the Mopop exhibit closing. Was this always kind of a long-term vision back in the late 80s to become a destination, or was it just kind of a dream that you hope to achieve by working hard?
More just out of desperation, you know, it was more out of having subsistence and a lifestyle. I never dreamed that I would be able to, you know, have, you know, 40 employees and host, you know, multiple in stores a month and, you know, be partners with bands that I love, and labels that I adore. And, but more than anything, I think it's hard for any record retailer or maybe any independent brick and mortar retailer, to really to be genuine about what they're doing if they're not in love with the city they're in and the scene that they're representing. And, you know, I am that. I mean, I give talks at schools on the history of Northwest music, the history of American music, and try to not only cultivate new customers, but just spread the love and the pride that our youngsters and our citizens should have. You know, Seattle's lucky to have the music that it does. But it doesn't continue if you don't have messengers out there, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You talked about partnering with the bands that you love. I mean, it's no secret. Pearl Jam, Eddie Vedder, big advocates of Easy Street Records. And, I mean, Live at Easy Street is one of the most well-known, you know, short live records that the band has released.
No, that was a full set. I was just talking to Eddie. I was like, you know that that full record needs to come out at some point. Yeah. It wasn't just seven songs.
From your lips, Matt.
Yeah. From here, there you go. I'm kind of curious though, like when you think back at just the musical and cultural revolution that happened in the 90s and just how that has served as kind of like a in many ways, like a fulcrum for so much of what has happened since for Easy Street. You know, like when you think about that, I mean, like what, just talk a little bit about that. Just the ripple effect and just,
yeah.
Do you ever just stop and pause and just like, wow, like that really was like a life lived in just a short span.
Yeah. Well, and what it's been, you know, 25, 30 years, you know, since, and even longer if you're get into the pioneers of the scene, but, yeah, it's, in many ways, the ethos of it is still very similar. You know, we're still anti-authority. We're still petulant and, you know, I have to think though that I'd have to think that maybe that scene started really out of just a desperate time, you know. But when you think about it, that was the last great music scene. I mean,
yeah,
you can talk about, you know, Manchester, I guess, which was around that time, shortly after. But when you talk about a music scene and culture and lifestyle in one city,
not many folks were getting Noel Gallagher's haircut. Let's put it that way.
When you tell me, has it happened since?
Not really.
You know, that was a
that big no.
Yeah, that was.
Oh well, I mean, Taylor Swift might beg to differ, but that's very.
She's her own thing.
She's her own thing. It's not really. That's a global scene.
She's like Chicago, Illinois by way of Tennessee, by way of New York, by way of Tennessee. Like I don't. Mm. Anyways. Let's talk about your favorite thing in the world, Luminate.
Oh, God. Okay.
AKA SoundScan and Billboard. Mm. Now, you penned an op-ed in Westside Seattle recently arguing that fair album sales representation was over, that collusion was afoot, with one company now owning both the accounting firm, essentially, and then the publication of those numbers.
Exactly.
Allow me to play devil's advocate here for one second. We know that correlation does not necessarily equal causation. With that said, I know this is an involved answer. In your estimation, what the hell is going on here? And why are these acquisitions detrimental to artists, music fans, and independent retail?
Oh, fuck. Because...
I told you.
Because when you start putting a conglomerate in charge of, in this case, owning the data provider and Billboard, they own the charts, then they manipulate them as they wish. They're looking for advertisers, you know, and this particular conglomerate not only owns Luminate, which was SoundScan and Billboard, but also Dick Clark Productions, Rolling Stone magazine, Vibe magazine, The New Yorker. I mean, the list goes on and on. Then you start talking about, you know, the absence of independent labels being on the charts. You know, once they purged January 1st of this year, they purged all 1,500 independent record stores. And you might ask, well, why should that really matter? Well, because, you know, the true soothsayers, you know, like the Pearl Jams or like the Idols or like the Brittany Howards or the Kid Cudis or Green Day or Killer Mike, they're not going to be accepted. And in many cases might even be excluded. And once those 1,500 stores are no longer reporters, well, now all you have is Walmart. Well, then now we're in a robotic milquetoast society where we're just reporting the sales from Walmart or an Amazon. And chart reporting had a lot to do with the success of 1991-92, you know. We, as Seattleites, we were all, the scene had already kind of been going on. You know, Screaming Life had come out a few years before that. Louder Than Love, Facelift, Temple of the Dog came out a week after, I think. SoundScan was created, SoundScan being the data provider that at that point was tabulating properly, at least the most accurate form of calculation for record sales. And boom, you know, I mean, Mother Love Bone never even made it on the charts. And yet, you know, at this point, we've sold, you know, thousands of Mother Love Bone. Does need to go back in print, I will say. But and then from that, it creates a culture, a lifestyle, and gives those artists confidence to carry on. Once there's a story to tell, being that you are now on the charts, it gives the record label a story to tell. It helps you get shows and tours and late night TV and you know, the subscribers of Billboard may not be as high as it was back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but there's still, you know, 17 million subscribers and 50 million followers. And what made this particularly dangerous is that Penske, the team Penske, which is the NASCAR group, they are the owners of Billboard. They're the ones, they also got the, you know, the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Trump back in 2019 because they won a NASCAR race. Okay. Lewis Hamilton had won four F1s in a row. I mean, come on.
Lewis has not come to the White House.
You know, without those sales, you would have never, I don't think you would have ever had the scene that we had. It would have never gotten exposed to the degree that it did. So January 1st, 2024 happens and all the indies are shut out and the Idols are number 137 on the chart. And in the UK and throughout Europe, they're number one. Green Day should have easily had a number one record. They didn't. I will say here right now, a deal is in play and there are still a good enough amount of people. That has not been announced yet, but it's being announced right here, right now. There are still a good enough amount of people at Billboard and Luminate and possibly one person at Penske that said, fuck it, let's bring them back in. Let's pay them for their chart and let's give some tech support to some of the smaller record shops out there.
This is excellent.
Fantastic.
And by April 19th, the week of April 19th, which is happens to be
now
street date of Dark Matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We should see a proper Billboard chart again.
So it took the coalitions.
Yeah.
There's a few of them.
Yeah.
It took them basically 3.5-4 months to say, hey, Street Pulse, which you guys created for this exact reason, right?
Right.
This is the accurate tabulation of independent music stores. Just add it. And they're saying yes now?
Yes. It is. It has been agreed upon.
All right.
I mean, this is
excellent news.
Yeah.
This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that to us. that's fun for us, but like, it's more fun for everybody. You know, I don't know about Paul, but I'll be at my local record store this coming weekend, you know, pick up whatever fun discs are still available when I walk in the door.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think that before this obviously announcement, do you think that part of the reason that they were doing this was to, I mean, we all know that studio albums don't make artists a ton of money. There's not a lot of money in that game anymore. It's more about the touring for them. Was this like a last gasp for them to just squeeze out as much money as they can before, since they don't get a cut of touring, or no?
I think it was to attract, to create their own Billboard 200 with essentially major label talent, pop talent, or country, or bubblegum hip hop, and to have them as advertisers. You know, keep in mind they also have Dick Clark Productions, which is
right.
American Music Awards, Billboard Music Awards, Country Music Awards,
and then Rolling Stone and Variety can report on it.
Right.
Exactly. There you go. Yeah.
So it's kind of like legal payola, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And the tentacles that Billboard chart had and still has, as much as, you know, I had friends saying to me, who fucking cares? I read your article. No one reads Billboard. It's like the algorithms of that chart go out everywhere, especially when those trade sources and publications are owned by the same company.
Yeah.
And so what I feared and why I wrote that article, the guy that published it actually took 5 pages out of it. Cause I went on a rant, you know, every night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I just couldn't stop.
That was 5 pages longer. That was quite long. I enjoyed it, but it was very long. I got a history lesson.
I saw this as dangerous as the Hollywood blacklist of the 40s and 50s. I saw this as dangerous as the Payola scandals of the 50s through the 80s, where the manipulation of the charts was infecting our culture, and our real culture wasn't being able to show its face. And that's what our scene from, you know, 91 on, was able to do. And I don't want to sound hypocritical because, you know, I appreciate the pop music that's out there today. But I will say that I feel as though the young people today are far more open-minded to all genres. When I was younger, it was split. You know, you're into punk or you're into metal, you're into hip hop. I mean, I remember being in middle school and it'd be like, okay, Grandmaster Flash and Kool and the Gang is going on now. Okay, the next song's going to be AC/DC, and then we're going to go to Cameo, and then, you know. So the youngsters today are just, they're more fascinated by all genres and all eras. You know, they'll buy a Strokes record at the same time they're buying a Doors record and a Pearl Jam record. And yeah, they might even buy a Taylor Swift record too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of those youngsters, you know, you talked a little bit about how a lot of these artists these days are selling directly on their websites or on Bandcamp.
D2C.
Now, yeah. And ironically, you know, I mean, that's not exactly good for your business, right? But it is good for them as musicians. It's good for the music community as a whole. And it's good for independent artists and labels. Are those sales being reported to Luminate and Street Pulse?
That's a good question. I was just talking to Tim Bierman about that from Pearl Jam HQ. I believe so. Yes. You know, in the case of like Kacey Musgrave, she sold 45,000 copies D2C the first week, and 38,000 to independents. So yeah, I mean, it's split. What I have issues with is the embargoes that the primarily the major record labels are putting on, or maybe even the management companies are putting on their artists and their and the records that come out, that we're not able to sell, we're not able to pre-order or sell as pre-orders until, you know, just a day or two before the record is released, so that they can gobble up all of those sales first before we get it. That I don't agree with. That's not very fair to in fairness to record retailing, regardless of what form of distribution it's coming from, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, we are mainly a Pearl Jam podcast, and there's been a lot of comments in regards to the various and numerous amounts of variants that Pearl Jam is putting out with Dark Matter. And by my count, there are, we got the generic black, we got a clear one, we got a red and black 10 club version, a yellow and black swirl record store day version, and then 12 regional variants. So that's 16 different versions of Dark Matter. Now, Billie Eilish just put out an article saying that artists shouldn't be doing this, hypocritically, by the way, and she did admit that she was being hypocritical.
I think she has 7 variants coming out on her new record.
I know.
Yeah.
Weird. Where do you stand on this idea? Because it goes into what you're just talking about with kind of being cut out at the beginning. On this whole like multiple variants thing.
It's that whole notion of spreading the love. You know, we got to give Target theirs. We got to give, you know, the indies theirs. We got to give Barnes and Noble theirs. Got to.
Is it actually helpful though?
You know, I'm a fan of Spin the Black Circle.
All right.
Well done. Well done.
But at the same time, I know that the pressing plants are having a lot of fun. They have a lot more, opportunities and varieties and technology to do what they do today, and that's fun for them. And it's a way for the artists to be able to take care of you know, various retailers, you know. It does come off as a bit greedy, you know. Something tells me though that Billie Eilish and Pearl Jam are doing it in an eco-friendly way. And how that's done, I'm not sure. You know, maybe they're using recycled vinyl, which is happening. You know, you can recycle that down into pebbles and then recreate it. And I know that especially someone like Stone Gossard, he would be the first person to want to know how are we being eco-friendly with
all what's of the our carbon variants. Footprint on every one of these units.
yeah. you know, maybe more so than even a Billie Eilish would be. I mean, he's so passionate about that. And so I believe, as I've always believed in them, that they're doing the right thing. But yeah, to your point, yeah, it's a bit much.
Well, as we head, we'll wrap up with this here, Matt. We're heading into the 17th Record Store Day, just a couple days away as this episode drops. And is there a release that you're most looking forward to?
That Malfunction release is something that, you know, we've never seen, you know, for all of Andy Wood and Kevin Wood and Regan to be able to put everything together in one package is great. You know, there's 400 titles this year. It'll be arguably the biggest Record Store Day that we've ever had, biggest Record Store weekend we've ever been part of. You know, there's, I just posted, I think it was yesterday, the G Love. I love G Love. So that, looking forward to that one. There's a handful. And off the top of my head, though, I need to, I mean, I did the order. So I went through every single one of them. And when I do the order, I mean, it's a all day event.
I can imagine.
Yeah. You know, cause I got to get into, you know, the storylines on every one of these records, and they're not returnable, you know? So you're gambling a bit, and, you know, yeah, it can be upwards of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars that you're investing in these records.
Well, for the many fans who are spending thousands to see Pearl Jam in Seattle this year, we highly recommend and encourage you all to pop into Easy Street Records and make sure you walk away with a souvenir.
Yeah, thank you. and make sure you get a photo in front of the Mother Love Bone mural that Jeff,
which, by the way,
did himself.
Jeff redoing, what, 30 years later? How cool is that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was all his idea. And, you know, he did that freehand in a matter of 3-4 hours.
Wow.
Those Ament brothers are pretty good artistically, huh?
Yeah. And then he designed the Cornell one that's right next to it. You know, we have a bar in there now too, upstairs.
I don't know what his name is. I forget, but my wife and I were up there, like I said, a year ago, and he could not have been cooler. Had a couple of Rainiers, had a couple of whiskeys. He found the copy of Live on Easy Street. We may have shared a whiskey, but I definitely bought a couple others for myself.
Okay.
But I think he may have had one. It was like, you know, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was in the afternoon. It was PM.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Very cool guy.
He's sober now.
Okay. What's the next in store? Can you announce that?
We just booked Slash.
Ooh, oh, fun.
Yeah.
Wait, with his blues gang?
Yeah, that'll be in the summer. That hasn't been announced yet, so there you have it.
Just was. Two exclusives,
dropping
Paul.
Pearls for us.
Matt's coming back every week.
My girls, Sophia and Marie, have been doing a great job. They've been the ones that have really been spurning the in-stores recently, and we're doing, you know, 2 to 3 a week. We're building a new stage. We're investing in more shows, and wow, and now with the bar, it's more of a venue.
So it's, you know, a destination.
We'll be, you know, adding better lighting and sound and all that too.
Outstanding,
Paul. That'll be great for us when we do our live podcast from up there.
Yes, it will.
Okay, yeah, you got it.
As I ask very, very politely.
What do you guys think of what you've heard so far with Dark Matter?
It's exciting.
Yes.
It's very vibrant. You know, there's it's a charged element to the music that I haven't heard in a while.
Mm-hmm. I was telling Paul the other day.
It feels fresh. I don't know.
Basically, Paul asked me what I was looking for in new music. Or I should say, let me back up. We did a mailbag, and one of our listeners asked us, what do you look for when you, when your Pearl Jam is coming? And, you know, when you're younger, you're looking for the quote unquote return to form. I want to hear tenor verses again. Okay. Well, now I was telling Paul, I want to hear an amalgam. And Paul said, you want to hear back catalog fusion? I said, yeah, I want to hear all the best parts of what they do, but like in some new way. And yeah. I think Andrew's doing that.
I heard it in its entirety at 4 o'clock in the morning this morning. John Burton, who works for PJ, had sent it to me. And it was one of those watermarked, you know, and it hadn't been approval on all this shit, but it was watermarked for 24 hours or whatever. What I didn't realize is that he had sent me that like 21, 22 hours before. And so I listened to it and then immediately wanted to listen to it again and it cut out. But I took notes of it. You know, the family was asleep and I just had my headphones going, and Bierman and I listened to it here at this house a couple days ago with some of the Easy Street crew. To your point, yes, I think it's going to be all of that you just mentioned, an amalgam of back catalog. Honestly, I mean, Dark Matter is a great song. Running, Running? Yeah.
Yeah, Running.
Running's a great song. Get ready, man.
We're just the beginning.
Besides those two songs, what like jumped off the page to you? Like, I can't wait for everybody to hear that song.
Won't Tell. For Stevie.
Waiting for Stevie is what I'm excited for, because yeah. I think as Cohen called it singles era, which, you know, that's
Upper Hand. Something Special gives off elderly woman
vibe.
It gives off those vibes, you know, roll the window down,
mm-hmm.
drive through the country and sing along. And there's a couple.
Am I going to cry?
I wouldn't say that it's, you know, better solo, you know, there's some of that, but it's more, I mean, Cameron and Amen are on a whole other fucking level at this point. And yes. After I listened to the record, I went back and listened to tracks from all the records, you know. I mean, I was up till 6 a.m. and the guitar playing is so much better than 10. And granted, 10 is 10. I understand.
Yeah.
One of the greatest records of all time. But a lot of that was energy and, you know, first record vibes going on. And these guys coming together for the first time, and Eddie getting his entire life out,
right,
out there. I would say the sequencing of the record is as strong as I thought. Avocado was the sequence that record. You listen to the whole thing, and then, you know, there's nothing that is. They have the anthems. They have the big anthems,
mm-hmm.
And the choruses, and you just know that they could do that every single time. So that they challenge us, as they always have. This isn't going to be a gift horse here. We're going to give you elements of that, but you got to stay with us. I mean, I think this is a record of, you know, coming out of an insular world that we all lived in to now wrapping your arms around your loved ones, your friends, and their fans. And that's what you're going to feel. Every one of these songs is a live track.
Yeah.
This very well might be the greatest tour that they've ever had with this record. Honestly.
You know, I mean, these are huge words, Paul, but I will say when I was able to see them. Well, Paul and I both saw them in 2022 on the, you know, delayed Gigaton tour. I was fortunate enough to go to Austin last fall. And between those three or four shows, whatever it was, I don't know that they've ever sounded the sonics and the tightness of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen them live since 98, mm-hmm. almost 30 times at this point. I've never heard them sound that good.
Yeah.
So like, this is what you're saying to me, like, oh my.
Well, they're in peak form. You know, I mean, it's
at just, 60, you know, as you do.
You get your Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours in a long time ago. they've hit that threshold.
Yeah.
And then some.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, if I wasn't excited now or before, I am now.
Yeah.
Thanks, no, Matt.
it's a record of, resilience, of, doing your part, and standing by those that you care about. And in this case, it sounds like they're standing, up for their fans and all of those that have followed them all this time. That's how this record comes off. Of course, we would all want them to get back on the cover, show their faces. Everyone has their favorite guy, but this isn't the Bay City Rollers. You know, I mean, these are guys that, take great pride in their abilities. And, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't remember Led Zeppelin putting themselves on their record covers either. So I think, how they've released these first two singles, I just laugh because there's so much good stuff on this. And if people think that those are the two best songs, I'm sorry. I mean, yes, but it's more about the whole record. And I just love that, on almost every single track, they've allowed McCready to just cut loose, he sounds like Jimmy Page, throughout the record. And
that must make Stone feel well, being a huge Jimmy Page fan. So,
oh yeah, well, that Stone groove. I mean, without the Stone groove, you got no PJ. I mean, he's the silent assassin of the whole damn thing. You know, yeah,
we cannot wait.
My goodness, Matt, I hope to do this again because this was a lot of fun. We can kind of dive even deeper into your relationship with Pearl Jam, because I know our listeners/viewers would love to hear some stories, if you're up for it.
Yeah. No, we never even got into how that infamous Live at Easy Street happened in the first place.
Well, we'll save it for part two.
There you go.
maybe ahead of Record Store Day Black Friday.
Okay.
See,
all about promotion,
Matt. You know. Well, Matt. I mean, I've got 45 more questions for you, but I'll let you go, and I want to thank you for spending your evening with us.
Yes.
I know it's a very busy grateful. Time of year for you, as I said before.
All right. Have a great night. Thanks for having me. All right.
Love that. So many great moments in that conversation with Matt. We thank him again for coming on the show. Really do appreciate it. All the kind Very words that he so. Said for us. I mean, Jesus, come on, Matt. Thank you for his time, the Absolutely. Insight, uh-huh. and his passion. That's the biggest thing for me, is the passion for the communities and the stores. I should say the communities, the fans, and the music.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's an advocate and a shepherd for something that's very dear to us, and I think to everybody listening, which is, you know, vinyl music, grassroots, and more than anything else, just the sense of community that gets fostered when people come around and coalesce around a certain kind of sound. But even beyond that, I mean, and Matt talked about this, I mean, you got folks coming in buying records from all eras at this point in time, and that speaks to my heart as somebody who literally will pop in a Francois Hardy record followed by a Pearl Jam record. So I'm all about it. So very grateful for Matt's presence, and very grateful, honestly, for his courage. I mean, you know, that op-ed he wrote and his voice, I think is a necessary one. And I think it adds a level of perspective that sadly was absent in a lot of ways. So
yeah, I agree 100%.
Keep supporting local record stores wherever and however you can.
100%. I co-sign that. And listen, if you're out there, if you're looking to buy music, please go ahead and try and do it from an independent store. Mm-hmm. As you heard Matt
That's
say,
where I get my Pearl Jam records.
It sounds like they're finally going to start recounting these individual, these independent stores in the SoundScan / Luminate, whatever you want to call them, numbers, which is great news. And just a real quick personal story, why that's so important to me as well. It's something that during the pandemic, my wife got me a record player, my first record player. I want to say it was maybe 2019 or 2020. And so during the pandemic, there wasn't a whole lot to do. And my oldest was, what, 2-3 years old then? Yeah. He really got a kick out of learning how to put a record on the platter.
My kids still do.
And moving the arm over, dropping
they
the needle.
They fight over it. I mean, they like dash over to that player. I'm with you. It's the best.
So it's like that's in an era of streaming, and I've adapted it. I'm sure you, Paul, and you, everybody else out there have over the years, cassettes, the CDs, the streaming, to whatever. That was a moment that kind of reset everything back to square one of what music appreciation and music listening and consumption really is meant to be. It's a tactile experience, as I know the guys in Pearl Jam really do appreciate and agree with, as of course does Matt and all the record stores out there. So get yourself a copy from an independently owned store, and let's keep this bad boy going. Let's keep this industry moving in the right direction.
Could not agree more.
All right, that's it from us, guys. We'll be back with you next week. Next week, we are talking to the man who made the Dark Matter album cover art and all of the art, including this bad boy right here.
Dark Matter single.
Am I gonna get this right, Paul? Alexander Gnezdilov.
Yep.
Was that right?
Gnezdilov. Yeah.
There we go. He'll be talking to us about how he made all of that art next week on this show. So stick around for that. Thanks for being here, guys. We really do appreciate it. And we'll see you next week. And until we do, you've been listening to
The State of Love and Trust.